Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share our observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Chris Perriello, Global Head of Secondaries at Carlyle AlpInvest. And we'll discuss current market conditions in his segment, as well as get his thoughts on the market for secondaries and broader capital solutions in private markets going forward. This episode was recorded on December 11th, 2025, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before turning to Chris, I wanted to discuss the three macro storylines of greatest consequence this year and their implications for 2026. First, I wanted to talk about tariffs, and I think the storyline, the development that was most consequential for 2025 was the transition from tariffs as a mechanism to narrow the U.S. goods trade deficit, which was the way it was discussed initially prior to Liberation Day and immediately afterwards, and transition to tariffs as a mechanism to raise revenue. This shift was obviously enormously consequential to management teams. When you think about the goods trade deficit in the U.S., a lot of it is explained by U.S. companies who focus their domestic activities in the U.S. on product design, product development, software development, branding, marketing, and of course rely on contract manufacturers elsewhere in the world, often Asia, to produce the underlying goods. So I think the recognition that some of the biggest losers of the tariffs would be U.S. corporations really is what prompted the shift. And this 15% average effective tariff, if you think about it, it's almost like a revenue maximizing tax rate. And it has raised enormous amounts of revenue, annualized rate of nearly $400 billion, over a percent of GDP. So that had an effect, of course, of narrowing the U.S. fiscal deficit in fiscal year 2025. It also meant that there was less bond issuance. So that revenue probably had some impact on reducing longer-term bond yields relative to where they would otherwise be. But more importantly, because this change in the effective tariff rates also was something that management teams could deal with, it felt like really more akin to an unwanted foreign exchange fluctuation. You know, 15% not helpful, certainly as upward pressure on prices led to a narrowing of gross margins, but it was in that range where, again, there could be corrective actions. It was something that people could get their head around, more like something that they have to deal with in the normal course of business. The second element that having knowledge of was very important for understanding the macro environment in 2025 was, of course, the understanding that we are in the midst of the most consequential, the largest concentrated CapEx boom in a generation. Entering the year, we estimated that only about 5% of U.S. GDP was contributing about 40% of U.S. economic growth. And when you have that sort of tailwind from this concentrated CapEx boom, it's hard for an economy to fall into recession. Certainly after the tariff shock, there were lots of elements in the economy that showed significant weakness. There was a pullback, there was a natural risk aversion, and yet this data center, the compute capacity boom and spending just powered through. And so at various times, the contribution to GDP was probably in the range of 60 to 70%. And again, this is something that I think people, had they had appreciation for the scale of the spending here, really wouldn't have been so worried about the economy succumbing to recession, even as, again, the underlying growth was from a relatively small, relatively concentrated part of the economy. The third theme is really just the Fed reaction function. There was a time earlier this year, many commentators suggested the Fed was in a box. You know, inflation above 3%, slowing economy, they really couldn't do anything. But of course, that's not really how the Fed operates. It is a dovish institution. It does have that sort of asymmetry, I think, in the reaction function. Inflation is explained away as transitory, related to goods inflation, something really not to worry about, whereas any sign of weakening on the labor side of the mandate, full employment side of the mandate, is attended to assiduously. And that's what we saw starting in September when signs of a slowdown in payroll employment growth and a really meaningful slowdown prompted the Fed to cut rates by 75 basis points. And so the Fed, you know, has our back. Those investors worried in April that there was not going to be any Fed response. That was proven to be not the case. And of course, I think that the prospect for rate cuts next year is something that we'll talk about in a moment. So those are sort of the three main storylines. And then looking forward, what to expect? Well, I think first with tariffs, I think it's obvious that the full inflationary impulse has not come through to product markets. And here, I think the Fed, again, still anticipates this is going to be a one-time effect. But, you know, when you talk to management teams, many of them have been reluctant to try to push on price or fully recoup the increase in the cost of goods sold because of a sense that it'd be self-defeating. End market demand is not sufficiently strong. They'll just have a decline in volumes that offsets whatever increase in prices they get. So they've been a bit more conservative. Going forward, if they feel the economy is strengthened because of the tax relief flowing through to refunds as a result of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the effect of rate cuts, just a cyclical upswing in the economy, they're likely to push on price. And I think that the idea that they're just going to stop right exactly when they fully recouped the increase of cost of goods sold is an unusual assumption. That they may, you know, having success raising prices, they may continue on, and that'll be interesting to see. Secondly, as it relates to the CapEx boom, something we've spent a lot of time talking about is questions about the return on this incremental capital, the return on what has been invested. We have seen a big decline in the cash return on equity. Some of the companies that are really big spenders in the space, net income has not declined by the same degree as free cash flow because, of course, it's capitalized. So that means that a lot of the go forward returns are going to depend on depreciation rates, and certainly a lot of uncertainty about the appropriate rate at which to depreciate some of this equipment, servers, GPUs, et cetera. And I think that this continues to be the big question for 2026, although most of this continues to be internally financed through the cash flow, operating cash flow of these very large corporations, there is more reliance on external finance. And that reliance means that at some point, of course, the market may demand much higher risk premia or just find itself less willing to fund some of these capital outlays without greater visibility on those end market native AI revenues, which at this point have not grown nearly as rapidly as the underlying CapEx. And then finally, you know, thinking about not just the inflationary impulse from tariffs, but also, you know, the extent to which immigration policy may have some upward pressure on wage rates in services sector, you have a Fed that I think many market participants expect is going to cut rates aggressively next year when there's a new Fed chair, when the administration is able to effectively take a majority of the Board of Governors. But in Washington, the big issue today continues to be what is described as an affordability crisis. And just a sense that, of course, this 22% increase in the consumer price level since 2021 is now being exacerbated by inflation that's still 100 basis points above target. So it'll be interesting to see how these political concerns interact, again, with market expectations for more Fed rate cuts as the midterm elections in November 2026 loom. So with that, I'd like to turn to Chris, and thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Jason. Happy to be here. Appreciate the invite.
I wanted to just start with a very general question about the market conditions and secondaries, just the transaction volumes, pricing, you know, really what you're seeing and expecting at this moment in time.
Yeah, sure. So I think if you look high level and you try to take apart the market volumes, what's happening and what's driving that, you know, just the headline numbers are fairly amazing in the sense of we're on sort of a 3 or 4 year run where every year we're setting a new record high just in volumes across all types of transactions, which we'll talk about. You know, where we got to the last couple of years, we crossed over the 150 to 160 billion mark going into 23 and 24, which, you know, if you look back only 10 years is sort of an unprecedented number. We can dive into some of those changes. And then you look at today, based on sort of the last 12 months trailing volume, we're looking for, you know, north of 200 billion in 2025, which again would be a record setting year. Those trends are persisting, and we'll talk about the secular versus the cyclical, but those are underlying trends that are continuing to develop the market volume. Now, pricing plays into that. I think people get, and we can talk more about this, people get really hung up on pricing in our market and how does it relate to returns, et cetera. I think the biggest impact pricing has on our market is volume, because there is a point in time when there's a mismatch on price in the market, volume will drop off. When pricing across the board is reasonable, volume will pick up. So it's more of an indicator of volume than it is returns. And today, I think we're in a reasonably good spot between the two, which is pricing has leveled off a bit post like 23 and 24, when there was more volatility in the system. So I think buyers are willing to put down a little bit of a bigger stake in the ground with the price. So let's say kind of 5 to 15% discounts are persisting in the market, which is a reasonable number to transact at. And that sort of comfort around where pricing is coming in is driving more sellers, both LPs and GPs, to basically consider the secondary market as one of their many options for liquidity. So they are linked together. So, you know, when you see extreme volatility and pricing pauses, volume pauses, we've had a good sort of 24-month run now of reasonable pricing that sellers can accept and quality volume for sale that buyers want to buy. And that's driving that volume.
I have a question. Is, you know, there's a misperception perhaps in the market where people think that returns to secondaries are really a function of the discount to NAV. What does drive returns in your market?
Returns in the secondary market, I mean, if you just look at our own personal experience and the market, the reality is if you cannot drive returns from underlying appreciation value at the asset level, you're not going to drive returns over time. You have to correlate the idea of discount is going to apply to quality, right? So at some point, you can capture discount early on by buying lower quality. And so sure, what people are looking at is that first mark. So there is the concept of if I buy something at 85 cents, I then get to market at NAV the next quarterly report. So you capture a nice gain optically day one. But then the reality starts to set in, and then you've got sort of a 2 to 5 year hold where either the assets you bought are going to appreciate in value and the GPs are going to drive that value and exit at an appreciated value, or they're not. If you buy discounted assets that are somewhat impaired, realizing that gain becomes very hard. So crystallizing that gain becomes hard. So we've always preached, and I think the market is coming this way a bit, you should buy quality assets managed by quality GPs and pay a fair price. We want to create value at the buy, no question, whether it be structure or deferral or purchase price or embedded value over the period of time that you have before signing and closing. But that's just to sort of jumpstart the deal. At the end of the day, if you're not generating 80, 90% of your returns from the underlying assets, you're going to struggle in many markets in the long term on your return perspective. So I think it really has to be asset quality, manager quality, and then the buy matters as far as how you structure the deal from an alignment perspective, from a purchase price, from embedded value, but that's not going to drive your cash on cash returns in year 4, 5, and 6.
I want to talk about distinguishing between what's cyclical versus what's secular. Obviously, when you have a number of years and each year the volumes are at record levels, there's probably something beyond any cyclical factors that are going on. And that seems to be the case. But how do you distinguish the two and what do you expect going forward?
So let's take the secular first. I think to your point, those are driving the industry to where we are today. And I think you have to break it up. And there's two elements. Everyone talks about the LP interest market. Again, LP selling a portfolio of LP interest, or the GP-centered market, which primarily consists of continuation funds, which is GP selling assets out of a fund in a specific transaction. The secular trends for each are a bit different. On the LP side, you have two things working in your favor as a buyer in the market today or as a participant. First is the increase in allocation to privates across the board in most institutional investors' portfolio allocation today. As that number has gone up, whatever it started to, wherever it's going to, you have new entrants coming into private equity, and you have institutions raising their targets for private equity in their portfolios. That is driving more fundraising in the market overall. So just having a larger pool of assets that are going to be tradable for us is a trend that has really been over a decade long at this point. The second element to that is, as the institutional market has become more familiar or more comfortable with using the secondary market, and again, not big discount, but using it as a liquidity management tool, you're seeing the churn rate. So what percentage of that churns go from 1% when I first started to today, it's close to 3%. So you're just having both those things happen, a larger pool and then a larger increase in the amount of that pool that will churn over time on an annual basis. On the LP side, that's the secular trend. The GP side is a bit different. It's basically looks like the LP side of 10, 15, maybe 20 years ago, where you started off in say 2011 and 12, really as an event-driven, almost, you know, distressed market with some continuation funds that were sort of restructurings, et cetera. So those were lower quality GPs, lower quality assets. But what happened, similar to the LP side, is the more quality GPs with the more quality assets started to realize that there are other ways to handle liquidity. Instead of doing a fund-to-fund transaction, or instead of doing a minority sale in an interest to raise some capital, you could do a CV on assets that you liked. So around 13, 14, 15, you started to see higher quality GPs enter the market. So back in 2011, it was 5% of total volumes was the GP-centered market. Today, it's close to 50. So that is a step change in just the amount of participants in the market, both buyers and sellers. Those are the secular trends. Now, the cyclical trends are driving the news today, right? Because the overarching theme there is very straightforward, which has been a lack of liquidity in the alternative space across the board. And yes, you can delineate between mid-market, lower mid-market, large market, venture, private. At the end of the day, the theme is still similar, which is liquidity is lagging capital formation in the sense of many institutional investors had expected more liquidity to come back, and many GPs had expected higher DPIs at this point in the life of their fund. Those two things are certainly driving the cyclical aspect of, well, the secondary market is an all equity liquidity provider. We don't need the public markets. We don't need the debt markets to be open. We can provide liquidity in a formalized way that is strictly equity based. That does put that feature at a premium in today's market. So that is the cyclical piece, which is driving it. But even if that falls away, the institutionalization of LP selling and GPs using the market for CVs is here to stay.
I want to talk about the GP-led secondaries, the continuation vehicles, because, you know, I find that this, of all areas of private markets, I think that there's probably the biggest disconnect between the assets that go in to CVs and some of the discussion or skepticism around it. In many ways, it seems to me, from what I observe on both the sponsor side, then and also, of course, the secondary investor side, that very often these are the best assets. And how would that be? Well, very often it's because of a sense that you want liquidity, you want to provide liquidity to your investors, but you recognize the asset you're selling has a lot of upside potential. You loathe to actually dispose of the asset because you see the future of the asset very bright over the next 5 years. So what's the most efficient mechanism in that case? Well, it's to roll over your equity to participate in another five-year holding period. But of course, critics will say, well, these aren't real exits. You know, you didn't accept the market's verdict is something that I hear repeatedly. What do you see in terms of the selection effect, in terms of the assets that ultimately end up in CVs?
It's a great question. I think the reality is, you know, there is some skepticism, generally speaking, because I think there are both ends of the market here, right? There are some participants, meaning GPs in the market, that are utilizing the secondary market as maybe a way to exit assets that aren't that attractive or didn't have an exit. That is a very small percentage of the overall volume. It even splits more when you get into the idea between a single asset continuation fund and a multi-asset continuation fund. If you take the single asset space, that is actually very easy in the sense of it is, I don't have a percentage basis, but it is the majority of high quality assets that fit what your description is, which is they have been winners in the fund. They're coming out of that fund because of the finite life period of that vehicle, and it might need more capital. It might need something else to realize a value creation 2.0 type story. And you're right, GPs are loath to get rid of that. If they have a good relationship with that existing management team, they have trust in the budgeting process and the operations team and the ability to manage or do M&A, whatever it may be. Historically, they have been loath to give that up to another bigger sponsor who's going to take it and run with it. So in the past, you know, pre 10 years ago, you might have saw a fund-to-fund transaction into their next fund, or you might have saw a way to do this or raise additional capital in the vehicle. So I think what they're doing now is realizing that I have this mechanism, which is very efficient, which allows my existing LPs to participate if they want, but it really does recapitalize a new vehicle. What you're just basically doing is setting a new timeline. So I mean, the capital coming in today has a 3 to 5 year timeline, as opposed to the capital that's already in the deal, which is probably in year 8 of a 10-year timeline. So that's what we're trying to find, is the right combination of why are we doing this deal? And I think it's incumbent upon us as buyers, and this is where, you know, I like our positioning in the market, is we have the relationships with the general partners from our primary program where it's a partnership with our GPs. We've done, you know, primary investments, co-investments, secondaries. And what I mean by that is we're both vested to make it work. No one is trying to get one over on the other party because we have a partnership that dates well beyond just this one transaction. That allows you that insight and the ability to navigate where should you spend your time. I think the single asset space has pretty much really curated around this has to be a great asset and there needs to be a story. The super cynical view would be, well, could they have maximized a little more value on a sale? That depends. That goes back to our current dynamic around, is it the right time to sell? It might be the right time for the fund life, but the wrong time for the market, so we can bridge that gap for them. The multi-asset deals, I think, are where there's more variability, because what you usually see in those deals is a construct of one or two or three assets that are the drivers of value. So they're similar to single asset type portfolio deals. Then you probably have two or three assets in that transaction that maybe aren't as great. So there is a little bit of cynicism around, well, those are exits being created. That, I would say, the positive way to think about that is that's the GP being creative. Here's the general partner of a fund, which maybe has a couple assets that have been challenging to sell, and they're linking them with better assets together, which in a portfolio sale, you're getting a premium for the portfolio for that. So I think they're actually, in some ways, if done right, can be providing a service to their LPs in the sense of they're finding a way to monetize and capitalize on the pool of assets that they have. And again, there's pros and cons of that as to where the asset's coming out on pricing, but there is more variability. And you'll see even on pricing of multi-asset deals where you will see discounted multi-asset deals. Most single asset deals, the starting bid is right around par. You're not going to basically come in on a big discount on those deals because then it doesn't really fit the logic. So the market, it's still new. I think the overarching theme is it is a relatively young market. It's less than a decade old. There are going to be good and bad actors in every good market as it develops and matures, just like there were on the LP side. So I think it's just a matter of if you have a buyer and a GP that you trust that are doing the deal together and they're presenting it to the LPAC in a way that makes sense and a process was run and choices are given and there's an option to roll. If it's done efficiently and done well, I think we're at a point now where 15, 20% of the exits in the market are really through a CV at this point, which means that it has become a much more institutionalized and professionalized business. LPAs become involved to make sure that the LP's rights are protected. So I think you're starting to see the dynamics put in place that are really professionalizing this end of the market. That's taken some time.
It seems to me, you know, from my naive perspective, just as an observer, not a participant, that the amount of equity or the amount of capital in the successor vehicle contributed by the existing sponsor, not only what is rolled over from the fund, but maybe a successor fund that then co-invests in the CV would be a very important piece of information about, you know, again, whether you're dealing with a bad actor or someone who, you know, again, genuinely sees a lot of upside potential in the asset appreciation potential. Do you monitor that? Do you have demands for the amount of capital that comes in? How do you think of that?
We have three elements we look at in every deal, and it's quality of the GP. That's our management team on an asset buy. It's quality of the assets. Can we underwrite it? Is it repeatable? How do we think about it? And number three is alignment. And we are pretty hard aligned on all three, maybe more than some others. So high level, how do we think about this? The GP should be buying this transaction with you and not selling it to you. And that is really what you're trying to figure out philosophically when you're sitting down across the table from the GP. And there are several ways that that comes across. First and foremost is cash, right? To your point, yes, we don't want any carry coming out of the deal. If there's going to be a crystallized carry event and they're not putting the money back into the deal, we're going to walk. We'd like to see additional capital come into the deal, whether it be from a new fund or from out of the pocket of maybe the deal team at the GP or the founders of the GP. We really want to see where it matters, right? We're not trying to punish people. We want to see people that have the capital saying, I'm so excited about this. How can I get more money in? Some founders take money out of their own pocket. Some deal teams take money out of their own pocket. Some new funds come in with a GP commit. We've had GPs out of our portfolio finance business do a management company loan to take that capital and put it into the deal with us. So we're willing to work with a partner. We just want to see the mentality of how do I get more money in? And I do think the other alignment issues come around, how do they think about fees and tiered carry and all that, but that's a negotiation. Money coming into the deal and money not going out of the deal is not really a negotiation for us. Because if we're not starting there, we're just starting off on the wrong foot. They don't have the right philosophy going into the deal, and that's fine. We'll move along. There's plenty to do. As we'll talk about, there's not enough capital in this market to satisfy the supply side. So we can just go to the next one if we don't like it. And again, this is where the relationships with the GP helps. You'll see us do multiple deals with the same GP because there's a trust there. There's an understanding of why should you be doing this deal. And we've gone through that with them in the past. So I think that is an important element. To me, it's very binary. We either get there or we don't, and we're not doing the deal if we don't.
I do want to talk about other things to do. Right now, secondary is the way to situate it or conceive of it is just part of this, I think, burgeoning market for portfolio solutions. or capital solutions in the private markets as they grow. And I'm wondering, you know, whether it's portfolio finance or other elements of secondaries, what most excites you about the development of this market?
I think that if you put it in a nutshell, it's been that concept. Whereas today, as a secondary fund, as a manager of secondary capital, I think probably in the past 3 to 4 years, this has evolved. We used to be a transaction partner, simple as that, right? We were capital, we provided liquidity, whether it be LP or GP centered. It was fairly straightforward in the sense of what were we doing in the market? What was our role? Our role was to alleviate liquidity pressures one way or the other in the market. Today, our role was really to be a solution provider. And I think the way we thought about it here at Carlyle AlpInvest was, well, then we should develop a product suite that satisfies that role. So that's why we expanded with portfolio finance. That's why we added credit secondaries and AV lending. Now, that's a different capital base. So there's different returns, different investors, different LPs, different transactions. But as a team, we face the GPs and the LPs as one team because we want to go walk into the room with, we're here to solve problems. We're not here to pitch you on a capital solution. We're here to figure out what do you need as a firm. And some of these situations have borne fruit in both ways. We've done a management company loan to a GP who needed to fix a financing issue. And then a year later, I've done an equity CV in our secondary fund because of that relationship. So as we thought about, to your point, what excites us, it was because we thought about everything, right? We could go different sectors. You could do an infra or a real estate or a venture fund. You could do all these different things around secondaries. But those to us were add-ons to what we already do. They weren't a fundamental shift. I think for us, it became, how do we become a corporate finance function in the market? How do we solve problems for LPs and GPs? And that was making sure that we have the right capital to line up for the specific need that that LP or GP needs. So that to me is what's exciting in the sense of that market didn't really exist 4 or 5 years ago. So I think the exciting part is, I don't know what's next. I know that we have a very sophisticated, you know, partner on the other side, whether it be the institutional LP or the GP, very creative set of people in this market. So as needs come up, it's very interesting for us to sit around and say, how can we solve it? I mean, the great part about our market is it is somewhat new in the sense of if you and the partner agree to a deal, we can do it. There isn't this blueprint that has to follow this mold. It can be what it needs to be for the specific issue you're trying to address.
Obviously, there's been enormous growth in evergreen funds. So for the most part, you know, you're transacting with drawdown funds. They're reaching the end of their life, as you said, right time for the fund to sell, maybe not the right time for the market. That sounds like the perfect opportunity for CVs, as you mentioned. What about evergreen? Could you imagine a portfolio solution provider to them? Maybe there's outflows, they need to dispose of assets, raise liquidity. What do you think about your role in that growing part of the market?
I think it's a fascinating question, right? Because all of the focus today has been on the buying side of having an evergreen fund. We've gotten a ton of questions around, you know, evergreen capital that we have raised to do secondary transactions, but it's all been on the buy side, capital formation of us having capital in that structure to go do deals. Separate topic. But what I think is interesting is what you're bringing up, which is these vehicles, and you know, we're learning a lot about them as we manage them ourselves. You realize that yes, they are evergreen. They don't need liquidity, quote unquote, but they do need a function, a liquidity function within the vehicle, usually beyond as they get bigger and they start to scale and the development of that NAV becomes bigger than the inflow model. You start to realize that there's going to be probably a need to capture some IRR to end life and to reinvest proceeds because if you think about the end game of these vehicles, having a very large piece of NAV growing very slowly over time doesn't work too great. You need asset appreciation. You need the new deals to come in and have influence. So I think as they scale, I don't think it's yet to your point, there's only a few scale members. I think there is going to be a role to figure out how can we, to your point, proactively approach that market. I think we'll have the advantage of managing our own, which will give us insight as to how you're really thinking about the operations behind these funds. So I do think there will be, it hasn't happened yet, there will be an opportunity to be one outlet of liquidity for that, the GP who's managing the evergreen vehicle, especially the evergreen vehicles that are focused on more direct investments with longer duration assets. There'll be a play there. It hasn't happened yet. I think it will be there.
Well, Chris, that was a really interesting conversation. Thanks so much for stopping in.
Appreciate it, Jason. Anytime. Happy to join.
And to our subscribers, thanks for listening. And I hope you'll join us for next month's episode of Insights and Indicators.